What'll it be?
I was going to fill up with whatever's cheapest.
I'll be happy to take care of that for you.
I thought this was self-serve.
We're completely full service here at Empire State Gas. Sure, it may cost you a bit more, but you're worth it. Now, what else can I get you? Something from the snack shop for you and the little lady?
There is no little lady. I'm alone. And I just ate.
Well, how about a complimentary balloon animal for the kids?
I have no kids, and I'm still alone.
Well, don't feel bad. You may be alone, but you're wise enough to come to the largest independently owned gas station chain in the Northeast United States.
We're in Los Angeles.
I'm sure that you know that our gas is organically grown and good for the environment.
Good for the environment?
That's right. When you burn our fuel, you're actually helping to reverse climate change. That's why we say at Empire State Gas, from farm to pump, we've got great gas.
And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Chillpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Hey, everybody. This is your Chillpack Hollywood Hour. I'm Phil Lairness, and in Motown, this is Dean Haglund. Hello, Dean.
Hey, everybody. How are you?
Did you enjoy a terrific 12th night, Dean Haglund?
Oh, my gosh. The 12th day of Christmas, my true love gave to me, I don't know.
But, okay. Well, so I'm gonna say that's a big no. I'm gonna say you're not romantic about celebrating the traditional meaning and events and days of Christmas. But thank you for asking. I greatly enjoyed the 12th night celebration, and in fact, you're the reason, the main reason I could enjoy the 12th night celebration, because you allowed us to schedule today's podcast at a decent hour. So I knew I could imbibe.
Oh my gosh, you partied on the 12th night of Christmas.
Yes. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
I didn't know it was a party night.
Oh, I mean, you know, you're trying to crown the king of 12th night and, you know, who gets the baby Jesus in the cake. And I mean, it's a lot of fun. And if you ever move back to LA, I'll bring you along sometime to one of these celebrations.
You're already bumming me out. Holy smokes.
So next week, we're going to spend some time. We have a guest and an interview, and we're going to spend some time talking about the things we look forward to in 2019.
Yeah. Ooh.
And at the outset of today's show, of course, we had a commercial for our beloved sponsor, Empire State Gas. And it's really one of the last times I felt that I could play this particular ad spot, because in it, I make reference to the fact that I have no wife. And that will be falsehood in advertising.
Wow.
In short order, will it not?
It will. My gosh. The days are flying by before I have to go to Williams-Sonoma.
I don't think we're registered there, but you mean apropos of another event. when the historic core of downtown Los Angeles, one must always visit the Williams-Sonoma in Glendale at the Galleria. I thought, you know, we're going to have to pre-record something for that Monday because there's no way I'm going to edit a show together, or we'll do it a day later or whatever. But I did think it would be kind of fun because it's a full weekend of events, obviously.
Yes.
There's the bachelor party on Friday. You got the rehearsal on Saturday, the rehearsal lunch, the welcome party on Saturday night, and then on Sunday, the wedding and the reception. And, you know, with our handy Zoom recorder, we could maybe do a little post game after each one of these events. How did it go? What could we have improved upon? What do we need to do better moving into the next event, and so on?
Yeah, I get it. So that it's sort of a play by play up to the big moment.
Yeah. And a behind the scenes. You know, like those. I don't know. There's a show on, I think it's HBO. I don't, you know, I'm not a big football follower, but there's a show called The Hard Knocks, I think, that's been on for a long time. And it's behind the scenes of one particular team leading into every game of the season. And so this would be our Hard Knocks, I guess. Our audio Hard Knocks if wedding.
Oh, I like it.
Wedding,
no, I think that'd be good. You
know, okay.
Just assemble it and then just hear how it all cascades into madness, basically.
Exactly. Which pretty well describes every episode of this podcast for 12 years.
That we slowly cascade into madness.
Oh, my God. And honestly, if we ever want to change the name of the show again, Cascading into Madness.
Wow. It's
really
not bad.
It is.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's not bad. Like so much of what we enjoy doing here on this show, it's not bad. All right.
Yeah, I like it. Okay.
When we left off last week, and we want to finish this up before we move on to other things, we were examining the calendar year that was and how and when some of the biggest and the most critically acclaimed movies of the year, 52 to be exact, were released. And
it's upended the old paradigm.
Yeah, how the paradigm has certainly shifted a considerable degree in the 12 years we've been doing this show. And that seems like a long time, but as we know, the paradigm had not shifted for decades prior to that.
Right. Right. It was entrenched, one would say.
Yeah, even with the advent of different home video and different, you know, auxiliary sources of revenue, ancillary sources of revenue, what would shift would be the theatrical window for a film, but not how and when those films would actually get released, just how long they would play. And
right.
And how soon thereafter they would be available on other formats, and so this last year we were looking month by month, and we got through the first three quarters of the year, though we had left one out, which I will bring to mind. But to recap for those scoring at home,
let me get my score sheet out.
Of the 52 top films of the year according to critics, one of them actually came out in January, and that was Paddington 2. Only one. So there was still room on the calendar for some films to come out that maybe could find a mark, even amidst all the holdover Christmas releases, right?
Right.
And I was thinking about this, Dean, because I was thinking that when you look at the calendar of last year and how many of these films could make a mark and could be remembered, it is really particularly important maybe in this day and age when cinema going has so many strikes against it in terms of cost and in terms of the limits of how long these films are available and how many screens are available. It becomes even more important to spread movies out through the year because you have a chance to get people back into the theater. And the more often people go to the theater, the more often they will go to the theater. Because going to movies is fun, but it's easy to forget that. And people need to be in the habit of it. And if they become aware that every couple weeks, perhaps, a great movie is going to come out, it's something to look forward to.
Right. Yeah. It's there's a term for that in marketing. habitual something or something. Make it habitual.
Yeah. Yeah. So February had three of the top films of the year come out, including, as we talked about, the biggest hit of the year. But sure enough, this year, I'm already reading how January is a wasteland, that the only movie that anyone has any hopes for in terms of not only box office, but certainly even quality, is this third part of the Unbreakable trilogy from M. Night Shyamalan, Glass. Like, all of January is riding on this. And why do we say that? Because if that's true, that's the only film that has a chance to get butts in the seat so that people at the theater can watch trailers for upcoming movies.
Right. Right. So all the trailers are going to be heavily... That'll be the heavy, you can see like a blockbuster and then sit through 20 minutes of trailers because, you know, that's the heavily attended one.
And you're desperate to get your film before that, your trailer before that movie then. So anyway, we'll see what happens come February. But last year, February, 3 films. March, 2 films. Obviously, there's 12 months in a year. And if we're talking about the top 50, 52 films... then what you want to see, what you expect to see, what you hope to see is 4 or 5 of the top films maybe being released each month, right? Then they're being spread out. April had 6 of the top films of the year. So whereas May, only 2. So March and May, 2 apiece. And sometimes, look, this is luck. You might think you have a great film. It, for whatever reason, doesn't get embraced the way... that maybe it even should be embraced. So there's never going to be an exact science to this. But clearly, 6 films in April, a lot of people with good films on their hands said, let's get this out before the mad torrent of big movies. And then in May, these big movies come out, and they're kind of dead on arrival.
Right. Well, this is, again, previews, marketing, you know, anticipation too, right? If it's big money in it, there's big names, there's a big director, you think it's going to be a big movie, and, you know, it's still an art form, so it still can suck.
Yeah, and I would say if you know you have something good, yes, play that game of find a spot on the calendar when you think it has a great chance to compete, but don't run in fear from any movie. Because right now we see that the biggest marketing budget does not necessarily lead to the biggest success. And sometimes pushing off against it can help.
Counter-programming.
So then we get to June and July and August, and now we're seeing what we want to see, which is 4 films in each of those months from the top 52 were released. 4. And then in September, which has actually, ironically, I've noticed over these last several years, kind of become what August used to be, which is sort of a dog, because it's a bunch of award hopefuls, but it's the weakest of the award hopefuls. So only 3 came out in September that were on the top films of the year list. And as we discussed, you know, one of them was absolutely not something anybody expected to be good, and that was the psychedelic horror film starring Nick Cage, Mandy, which turns out to be spectacular. The one film that I overlooked from September is a documentary called Bisbee 17. And this was released on September 5th, and it was from director Robert Greene. Did you hear about this?
I did hear something about this, but remind me.
Well, you know, I went and did a bunch of photography there in Bisbee for Truth Is Out There 2, and it's a fascinating, fascinating town. And not long after I'm there filming, this documentary comes out. And Bisbee is an old mining town on the Arizona-Mexico border. And the town, on the 100th anniversary of this event, so in 2017, finally came to terms with, or at least tried to reckon with, its darkest days of events that took place 100 years before when 1,200 immigrant miners were forcibly deported. And it was ugly. And boy, it resonates 100 years later. And all the locals in Bisbee today collaborated to stage the recreations of this controversial past.
Oh, wow. Wow. They recreated the actual, like, marching and everything?
Yeah, yeah. And Bisbee, and we'll talk about Bisbee more, especially as I get closer to being done with Truth 2, but Bisbee really resonates with what's going on in the country and the world, and in terms of paranormal exploration, and so much more. Crime, exploitation of nature. I mean, it's really a, I don't know, it's a cauldron of exploration and, I don't know, just cultural analysis to me.
Wow. How big is the town now?
A couple thousand people. But at one point, it was the largest city west of the Mississippi. I'm going to throw in a couple of S's in there, if you don't mind. It was the largest town west of the Mississippi, not named San Francisco, at its height.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was a big, big deal. All right. So we're into October and the films that were released there. And October got started in a big way, with three films on October 5th that have been among the top 50, according to critics, this year. One is the huge hit, A Star is Born. And,
okay.
And this, of course, will get a Best Picture nomination.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, look, I defy you to argue with me about this, but as I say, I wasn't a huge fan of it. But I will go to my death believing that of all four versions of A Star is Born, this is one of them.
Well, there you go. So Best Picture nomination. Write them up.
Another film came out the same day, and it's a Netflix film. And we've already been discussing several of these. But Netflix kind of dominates the year in movies. And this was from Tamara Jenkins, a wonderful filmmaker. This is only her third film as director since she made her breakthrough movie Slums of Beverly Hills 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
So again, another director like the great Patty Jenkins, who makes an acclaimed award-winning movie and then doesn't get to work for a decade in movies anyway. And I firmly believe the times have changed. And thank God they haven't changed too late to help the likes of Tamara Jenkins. Anyway, she made a movie for Netflix called Private Life. It stars Paul Giamatti and Catherine Hahn as two people approaching 50 who are desperate to have a baby, and what they have to go through to try to have a baby of their own rather than adopt.
Right.
And
funny.
It's potentially funny. I'm 50, Dean. There's a lot of this I don't want to see.
It's too close to home. Is that what it is?
A little bit. And just the details of it, you know, I mean, I know that this, I love authenticity in movies. There's nothing I like more. I love intimacy in movies. I like when things get messy. I like the messiness of human experience. We've talked so many times before about how it's the accidents when you're making a movie that are the most memorable part. Right. I mean, I've been thinking about nature, right? And how humankind so often wants to correct what we find to be the flaws in nature. But when you pull back, you realize that the flaws are the point in the design. And artists know this, right? In painting.
Improvisational accidents. And hidden patterns.
So this is what I love. And at the same time, I'm okay if when you see, for example, the miracle of childbirth in a movie, if the baby comes out clean.
You okay with that?
Yeah. So there's just certain things that I don't, you know, I don't know. Certain kind of examinations, I don't need to be intimate. I can't even go to the doctor. I haven't gone to a doctor in more than a decade. So I don't want to see someone else doing it.
Wow. Wow. This is very telling. Wow. Yeah. Well, you know, I could.
Anyway, maybe we should. Maybe we should. Maybe we should move on.
Maybe
there's a comedy, and I had stuff written about this from George Tillman Jr. It came out October 5th, and I've lost my notes. But it was a movie called The Hate U Give. Do you remember this? What do you know about this?
This was that screenwriter, and he passed away the opening night, right? The day it came to screen.
Oh, that was how. Right. We talked about this. You're absolutely right. I knew I had this in my notes somewhere.
Yes. It was one of our celebrity deaths. She was a screenwriter. Her name's escaping me at the moment. She wrote this. It got made. And then she went to a preview or a private screening. But then opening day of her movie, she passed away.
And it, do we remember what this movie is about in any way, or I don't know.
The Hate We Give? No, I don't. I don't think I actually saw it. Well, I was in the midst of moving around. October was a tough thing to stop a movie.
And if you hadn't, been moving, of course, this would have been the first film you would have gone out to see. Star Carter is constantly switching between two worlds, the poor, mostly black neighborhood where she lives and the wealthy, mostly white prep school that she attends. So it's an uneasy balance between these two worlds, and that uneasy balance soon gets shattered. So what we love about this already is that it's not just a fish out of water story, it's a fish out of water in two different neighborhoods, in two different milieus, because it's impossible to be of both, one would think, and truly of either.
Right. So you live in this limbo, this purgatory, this in-between ether.
So that sounds fascinating. I now really want to see this. And again, you're right. It was from the wonderful Audrey Wells, who I had made a little documentary for of one of her previous films. So The Hate U Give, October 5th. Then the next week, so that's three already in October. October 12th, the fourth of the top 52 films of the year to be released this month, and there would be many more. It's Damien Chazelle's First Man about Neil Armstrong and his personal journey that he takes in order to take that journey to the moon.
Right. Oh, right. What it took to just to get on that spaceship.
And
it's the prequel.
And that's back in theaters to a degree. I think it's having a late season kind of push where some people are saying, you know, maybe we didn't give this quite
a full shift.
Yeah, quite the reception it deserved. But a couple months later, and I think there were a lot of people that did what we always, you know, caution against, which is reviewed the film for what it wasn't rather than analyzing it for what it was. And,
right.
And like we talked about, the claustrophobia that the film achieves, which feels appropriate.
Yes.
Also would feel maybe overwhelming for a lot of people.
Oh, is it like the Das Boot of space? Is that what you're saying?
I think you said that when the movie came out, actually. So,
did I?
Far be it from me to agree with you, even as a callback, but maybe. So that may make some awards lists here coming up. And award season's getting into full swing. I mean, the Golden Globes were last night. We don't know who won because we're recording before that. And the National Society of Film Critics just announced their awards. Best Picture went to The Writer, which I told you about last week.
Yes.
Chloe Zhao's amazing, amazing film set in the Badlands of the Dakotas. And all the real people playing themselves and It's a powerful movie. I mean, it's really powerful, and it truly is one of those movies that's more powerful because you're aware you're watching actual people, not actors.
Right.
Certain scenes don't affect you as much as if they were actors. But this awareness adds a level of, you know, I was saying this actually, and I didn't mean to talk about the writer, but since it won Best Picture at National Society of Film Critics, why not? You know how when you're watching a good movie, you might be really worried about what's going to happen to the main character, right? You might really be concerned. And yet, you know, it's just make-believe.
Right. But you got to suspend your disbelief.
And you're still invested. These people have become real enough to you that you care, and you don't want something bad to happen to them. And that is a kind of suspension of disbelief and depth of feeling that the writer does not achieve. The actors are not, they're non-actors. These real people do not achieve that. You're not worried about that per se. But at the same time, because you know that you're following a protagonist, for example, who had to give up this because a horse hoof went several inches through his cranium and into his brain. And he has, neurological disorders and injuries as a result of that. And that every time he gets on the horse, it is a threat to his very life. You're sitting there watching the movie going, they're getting this guy up onto the horse to recreate certain things. He's doing it himself. Did this movie kill him?
Right, because you do multiple takes. This is what I think always about, too, when I see a movie where there's a dangerous stunt and stuff like that. You know, often, the camera's out of focus. Some crew member puts a microphone in shot. There's all these things. So to make a guy go up again and again on a horse for one scene, I would think that's abnormally cruel.
So it's this different kind of investment, but because you're always aware, so this film lives in this interesting place between documentary and narrative fiction, because you are truly concerned about this guy in a much more real way than you're used to when you suspend the disbelief and worry about a character. It's fascinating.
Cinema verite. And post-war Italian film.
Yeah, that's true. Meets Terrence Malick's Badlands. That's actually a really apt comparison. And I know that Terrence Malick was a huge hero of Chloe Zhao, which is why a woman who grows up in China and then attends NYU film school, when it's time to make her first features, goes to the Badlands of the Dakotas because she's chasing a hero. Because, as she said in an interview, water terrifies her, so she couldn't be working near a coast, which I think is funny. Anyway, all right, so we're still in October, and what was it? We had talked about First Man, and and I've lost my place. So there we go. October 19th, the 4th, no, the 5th. Of the top 50 movies to be released in October, Mary L. Heller's Can You Ever Forgive Me? And of course, I raved about this when it came out. It's going to get Melissa McCarthy a very deserved Best Actress nomination, and Richard E. Grant, even more to the point, a very deserved Oscar nomination.
Fantastic. I haven't heard a thing about this movie.
Except when we talked about it, you mean, on the show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except...
It's the real story of Lee Israel, the writer who, the author who, to make a living, because writing books isn't the glamorous life you think that it is, especially living in New York, she starts selling memorabilia, famous letters from great writers and wits of the past, and it turns out that they were all forgeries that she was creating.
Oh.
So it's the true story of that, of Lee Israel. So that came out on October 19th, still doing quite well, I think. And then a movie that I can't wait to see, honestly, this is the first Korean film to make the Academy Award shortlist for best foreign language film. Think of that. Ooh. The first Korean film. South Korea has such a movie industry, and this is the first time any, and they've produced great, great movies, but this is the first time that one has made the shortlist. It's from the outstanding filmmaker Lee Chang-dong, who did Poetry in 2010 that got a lot of awards, especially Best Actress awards from critics. It is an out-and-out mystery film. And once I read that, I went, okay, I don't want to know anything more about it. I can't wait to see this. But this came out in limited release on October 26th, and I will be seeing it very soon at the Directors Guild. One of the things I look forward to, you know, when I was a kid, it was always funny. I mean, I don't know if you felt this way, but January was always a little bit of a depressing thought because the holidays are over and you got to go back to school.
Right. Yeah, it's a bit of a bummer. And it's cold. It's gray. Sun goes down early. Well, that's Canada, I guess. You didn't experience that in California.
But I now look forward to January as much, if not more, than any other month of the year because I get to catch up on so many great movies from the year before, but specifically the foreign language films from the year before. That is always so exciting for me.
Did you say the title of this exciting mystery?
Burning. Burning.
Burning. Oh,
National Society of Film Critics, best foreign language film, I think, or at least it was the runner-up to Roma. So that's really the problem that everybody has. Roma is so far and away hailed as the greatest film of the year. So my question is, could a foreign language film actually win Best Picture this year? It would be maybe it could happen. And if it did happen, would it also win Best Foreign Language Film? What if you had a circumstance where a foreign language film won Best Picture but didn't win Best Foreign Language Film?
Wow. Could that possibly? Well, could it could happen.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Because you have to say, you have to sign in to screenings, I think it is, to be able to vote for foreign language.
Ah.
You know, to show that you've seen them. But anyway, wouldn't that be spectacular? Anyway, so also in October, the same day as Burning, October 26th, and not the last of the best films of the year to be released on October 26th. No, not by a long shot. But the second that we're discussing, Suspiria from director Luca Guadagnino. What an odd combo this was for me. This is the director who made I Am Love with Tilda Swinton, A Bigger Splash with Ralph Fiennes, and the recent critical and award darling Call Me By Your Name. So this guy makes these intimate, lush character dramas. And he's the guy that makes the remake of the Dario Argento supernatural horror classic, Suspiria.
Suspiria.
And it came out on October 26th, making lots and lots of top 10 lists. So one of the must-see horror films of 2019, and there have been several.
Good Lord. So all of this is being crammed towards award season. Is this what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, so we've already had, what did we say? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We've already mentioned 7 of the best films of the year coming out in October. And I'm not done. Here's an 8th also coming out on October 26th. And I can't wait to talk about this one with you. This is, have you heard of the company Netflix? This is a Netflix film.
Right.
And get this, it comes out a week before The Other Side of the Wind, the Orson Welles film. Why do I bring this up? Because Netflix, 1 week before The Other Side of the Wind, releases Shirkers from director Sandy Tan. In 1992, teenager Sandy Tan and her friends Sophie and Jasmine shot Singapore's first indie road movie called Shirkers.
Wow.
With their enigmatic American mentor, George Cardona. Well, here's the first enigma about an American named George Cardona. All right. Sandy wrote the script and played the lead. a killer named S. It's like a French film, right? Like, we only give an initial for the main character. After shooting Wrapped, Georges vanished with all the footage.
What?
Yes. 20,
nice guy.
20 years later, the 16-millimeter film canisters were recovered in New Orleans.
What?
Sending Sandy, now a grown woman, obviously, in her 30s, and a novelist, living in Los Angeles, not Singapore anymore. She's now a grown woman in her 30s, writing novels, living in Los Angeles, and this discovery sets her on a personal odyssey across two continents, several decades, and many media, 16-millimeter, digital, high 8, super 8, slides, and animation, and handwritten letters in order to piece together not only that film, but a documentary of what happened and how all this was recovered. It has been described as a kaleidoscopic punk rock ghost story.
No! No story on top of all that?
It is being majorly pushed by Netflix for Best Documentary Feature, and it sure sounds like a documentary like no other, except for perhaps the film that Netflix released on November 2nd, Orson Welles' The Other Side of the Wind, which is a narrative film like no other, but a narrative film whose story is very similar to the documentary film Shirkers.
Wow, that's right. It's a filmmaker that's, finding the lost footage, the whole thing.
Yes, Shirkers is a documentary about the putting together of a narrative film and the mystery surrounding that. The Other Side of the Wind is a narrative film about the documentary being made about a famous filmmaker's unfinished film and the mystery surrounding that.
Right. Wow. How weird. They both come out at around the same time.
So then, the next week, November 9th,
mm-hmm.
Have you heard of this company called Netflix?
Remind me.
They released a Western anthology that I love called The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Right. This bummed me out a lot, actually, that every one of those stories was just quite a, well done, but holy downbeat. Some of them are downbeat.
Well, no, they all are. But the thing is you go back and you go, just by comparison to where it gets, those original ones seem so frothy and lighthearted. Like, you're stunned by how downbeat they are, but the tone of them is so delicate and light. And
Well, it has to be. If you put a heavy hand on that, it's just too crushing.
But what's spectacular about it is, and I have a feeling we'll talk about this film more when we do our top films of the year, but the last in the anthology, the tone is so dark. The mood is so crushing, right? We're talking about The Stagecoach. Piece. And yet, nothing bad happens. At least you're not sure that anything bad happens. And yet, it's the most soul-crushing of all of them.
Right. I know. What does this say about the Coen brothers? Has Hollywood crushed their souls?
I don't know. But I love that they made this for Netflix. I love that. What's the ad line again? Stories never die, people do. Is the ad line for The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. It's so much fun. I can't wait to check it out again.
Awesome.
So that's the second of the top films to come out in November. November is much more manageable. Two films on the top list came out on November 16th. One is Widows, which I've talked about when I ranted against Steve McQueen, and I still believe this. I think he's an exploitation filmmaker dressed up as a message auteur.
Right.
And or he's both. Or, quite frankly, he's both. Maybe.
Right? Embrace his shadow, maybe.
And the same day, another film that I'm pretty sure will get a Best Picture nomination and may even win Best Picture, even though it's not the movie that several of these others are, but it's the kind of movie, it seems to me, that the Academy can get behind. And I truly loved Peter Farrelly of the Farrelly Brothers, his film Green Book, starring Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali, playing the great Don Shirley.
Right. Based on a true story, the bodyguard driving around a college professor in the South, right?
Yes. Yes.
Right.
On November 21st, this startup company Netflix released a film.
Yeah. Okay. Heard things about this guy.
From Alfonso Cuarón, one of the greats. His first feature since Best Picture winning Gravity. It is perhaps this year's Best Picture winner. Certainly the film, like I said, far and away, head and shoulders, twice as many votes, twice as many critics lists as any other movie of the year, Roma. And, you know, it really, whether I liked it as much as other films, whether I think it's, I mean, this is just the thing I'm stunned by. You watch it and you go, okay, Alfonso Cuarón shouldn't actually even be discussed among contemporary filmmakers. The context that we need to be discussing him is Tarkovsky and Fellini and right. and that crowd.
Right. Right. So,
and so we've always championed him. I mean, going back to, you know, God, Children of Men, for crying out loud. Prisoner of Azkaban. I mean, this guy was always the real deal, but that's the conversation he's in now.
Wow. But Roma, of course, you could tell the power of a director by, when they bring a black and white film to market. Normally that's indicative of death at the box office.
Yep. Black and white, master takes, non-actors, oh, did we mention foreign language?
Foreign language.
And, why not? Why not a Best Picture nomination? Absolutely. November 23rd,
right.
The first of two of the top films of the year to come out that day, Yorgos Lanthimos' third feature film, I think it's his third, after The Lobster and Killing of a Sacred Deer, The Favorite. And this may be the favorite for Best Picture, though I have a hard time believing the Academy could get behind this, having seen this last night. But I will say this about why this is so good and why I felt The Lobster was overrated. I think Killing of a Sacred Deer was actually a little bit underrated. But this is a man who makes a dark comedy every time out of the gate thus far. And
right.
To show the worst of human nature, the most petty or pathetic or laughable of human nature, he has always gravitated towards, previously, these science fiction settings.
Right.
And that setting was what interested people so much, I think, about The Lobster. But it's also what kind of, to me, made ultimately the dark comedy be about nothing. Because it didn't resonate with real world. It didn't hold up a mirror that made us feel the darkness of our own existence and souls. The way that a dark comedy ought to shock us and disturb us and make us question things. In Killing of a Sacred Deer, he planted his setting much more real world. It could be the real world. It's only what goes on in the relationships between the main characters that lets you know that it's science fiction. So for the first half of it, it actually really works as dark comedy really well, as an interesting commentary about marriage and family. But ultimately, again, the science fiction, for whatever reason, lets us off the hook. Makes it be about, boy, that film gets dark. As opposed to, oh, God, we're dark.
That's too bad.
But the favorite.
Sci-fi distance you is what you're saying. Science fiction as a distancer.
At least for him. I mean, it didn't for Kubrick, but it has for him. And now we come to the favorite, where he puts his dark comedy, and it is very funny, this movie. He puts his dark comedy in a historic realm, not a historically accurate realm, but a historic realm based on real characters and the broad stroke actual events of history. And that works perfectly to show within the ridiculousness, the mental illnesses of the rich and powerful.
Right.
Allows it to be really funny, while at the same time slowly casting the spell of, you know, this might be what it means to be rich and powerful in any age. And how are we not living in this age right now?
Wow. That's a good one. I always love it when that happens.
So he's,
that's why you want to watch historical dramas.
Yes. Yeah. When you do, right? I mean, it's going back to Shakespeare. You're transported from the here and now so that you are brought closer into contact with something of the here and now.
And, yeah, exactly.
And he does it. And science fiction at its best does that. I'm just saying that his dark comedies, for me, they didn't quite close their fist. Critics love the ideas of The Lobster, audiences less so. Everybody seemed dissatisfied with Killing of a Sacred Deer, though, like I'm saying, it actually was a mark of growth for him. It may have failed its aims more than The Lobster did, but it was closer to Yorgos Lanthimos finding the full expression of his voice.
Wow.
And so now The Favorite is really funny and really dark. Okay, November 23rd, we had the Japanese film Shoplifters released. Not enough time really to talk about any more of these because we got to get to some celebrity deaths. But but this film, a lot of top 10 lists. We will be talking about it in the future from director Hirokazu Koreeda. Shoplifters. This is a very cool film. So that was November, a packed November again.
Packed
one,
November.
Two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Again, no fewer than eight, which I think was the same as October. So again, maybe we could have spread these out a little bit more, especially when we're looking at September only having three of the top films, right?
Right. But we got to gear up for award season. So.
But as we're saying, a lot of the films that are in the biggest running for awards, your Eighth Grades, your First Reformed, these came out early in the year and they were able to make their mark. And really, The Rider, these were films that had a chance to really plant their flag in critical and public consciousness. And so they're powerful enough films where their roots run deep. Wow, that was almost poetic. What I just said. See what happens when I'm allowed to sober up? It really.
We'll do it. Yeah, we'll do more sober shows from now on. We say.
All right. So then December, not a top film released until December 14th, when we get two of them. We get If Beale Street Could Talk. This is the follow-up to Moonlight from Barry Jenkins. We've discussed this before. And a film that I think is the front runner now to win, best animated film. And it's making a lot of top 10 lists. It's Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. It looked cool in the old trailer, I'll say that. I'm glad critics are digging it.
I don't know the last superhero movie to get this kind of great reviews, maybe since Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight. And it's just that, you know, magical animated film every so often that really people just hail as a truly great cinematic effort. But I haven't seen it yet. It's got an enormous team of directors, writers, and producers. It came out on December 14th. It's being pushed for lots of Academy Award love. But Dean, I had promised this last week, this story. I was in the subway in New York at the bottom of the island coming up out of, or just leaving, actually getting off the Staten Island ferry. And I'm going down the subway, and these young women, possibly late teens, early 20s, I don't know. It's hard for me to tell these days. Everybody looks so young. But these young women of color are on the escalator, and they're pretending with each other to be Spider-Man. You know, probably teens, these girls. And I thought, this is not something I've ever seen and not something we could have ever seen until Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, where everyone gets to put themselves in the hero's role, not just young white men.
How about that?
Yeah.
How fun is that?
That's kind of cool.
And they're shooting webs at each other and stuff. That's so cute.
All right. We wrap up with the final three. December 21st, Poland's entry into the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. It's on the short list. It's from the director of the Academy Award winner from 2015, Ida, Paweł Polakowski. It's Cold War, and I'll be seeing this in short order. I'm sure this packs a goddamn wall up, this movie, Cold War. Right. From Poland, are you kidding me? Right there. You lost me. You lost me at Cold War. No, I love films set in the Cold War. I mean, what could be...
more chilling.
Yeah, more chilling. Yeah. All right. on Christmas Day, we talked about this film from Adam McKay, Vice, the quasi-biopic of Dick Cheney. And finally, at the end of the year, released onto Netflix, no theatrical release. Netflix has championed it. From Italy, Alice Rohrwacher's Happy as Lazaro. This is a film I'll be checking out in the next couple days. But boy, is it possible that more than a quarter of these films had Netflix attached to them?
Well, they got an $8 billion war chest for 1 year of production. So, yeah, it wouldn't be surprising that they managed to nab some big talent. $8 billion to spend in production.
But it's not about the money, though, because
it's not about the money, but it's the ability to garner, to send people out to the festivals to find these things and to purchase them and distribute them, have a platform.
Well, and produce these, though. I mean, like Bird Box, turns out 45 million people watched that the first weekend it was streaming. 45 million, Dean Haglund. Yeah, if that was released to theaters, that means an opening weekend of $500 million. But that's about money. I'm struck by, they were putting money into this in years past, but they have the financial model that allows them to course correct. That's the thing. And they do course correct, because we would talk about this in years past. Boy, they cannot. Netflix and quality movies was a contradiction in terms, even when they were trying. And and now they've nailed it. So,
well, it's a learning curve, right? Absolutely, course correction. We all grow and we learn when we're trying to achieve.
Well, you hope that, but a lot of times it doesn't, right? I mean, the curve stays a curve until the company goes out of business. A lot of times, it is amazing. Now, speaking of Netflix, of course, there's always the binge watching of TV shows,
right?
And I guess we should really save this to get to celebrity deaths. But I am curious about us in the wake of the movie season, not losing sight of television. And I've been binge watching on Netflix. Norm MacDonald has a show.
Oh, yes.
Which got terrible reviews and people are hating it. And it's fantastic.
It's fantastic.
It's just...
How many has he done? He's only done 10, hasn't he?
Yeah, I don't think he'll get a second season, but given the reaction to it. But it is so good. So I want to get to talk about that. I did season 3 of Man in the High Castle for Amazon Prime, and I've begun Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. So I want you to come up with what you've been binge watching, because you always have some interesting television series. We're not doing our best of television shows of 2018. Too much else going on, but I don't want to lose sight of some of the shows you've found. So make up a little list for yourself, and in the next couple of weeks, we'll get a chance to talk about it.
I can't wait.
Cool. And I would like to ask you this before we go to these celebrity deaths.
Okay.
I don't, as you know, binge watching doesn't mean the same to me as it means to a lot of people. Because I think binge watching often allows bad work, you know, because you're drawn by plot. And I got to find out what happens next. And that doesn't mean that the storytelling is good. But
right.
I will say that when I get into a show, I want that to be the only show I'm watching. And so I will watch that. Maybe I'll go back and forth between a drama and a comedy. Maybe, but I don't really even like that. If I'm going to watch the whole show, I need to really be watching the show. And obviously, if shows are on broadcast television and I'm keeping up with them, something like The Good Place or a Project Runway or whatever, I'm recording these and I'm watching these week by week for the most part as they come out. But if an entire season is available and that's when I'm coming to it, that will be the only show that I watch until I'm done with that season.
Wow. Well, that's good of you. So you're not flipping. You don't have two binge watching back to back. And then you're like, oh, I've watched too much of this. I'm gonna have a sorbet, as it were, and watch some comedy, and then go back to my crime drama. You're not doing that?
No, but I sense from you suggesting that is how you approach it.
Well, I'll throw in some so that I can reflect a moment on the journey of perhaps my lead detective or the funny person.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess my sorbet is to watch movies.
Oh, yeah. There's that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And, of course, my sorbet is to discuss celebrity deaths.
Yeah.
Celebrity deaths.
So, the first celebrity we have to remember, Dean Haglund, Sister Wendy Beckett. Do you want to tackle this one?
Yes, of course. The art critic. Who loved art and was a PBS show, I believe, where she would go and talk about art and sculpture. I learned a lot from Sister Wendy.
Did you really?
I did, actually. Yeah, I was in, I guess her show came out just, what, in the late, mid-90s? I can't remember.
So,
but I would watch it, actually.
Yeah, so she began studying art history in the 1980s when she was well into her 50s.
Right.
And she wrote a book on art history in 1988 to help her convent earn money. And in 91, the BBC asked her to host a documentary about the National Gallery in London. And that documentary involved her just standing in front of paintings without a script, talking about the paintings.
Right. Yeah, she was well-versed in the paintings.
And the program was so successful that she was asked to host more documentaries for the BBC, including Sister Wendy's Grand Tour and Sister Wendy's Story of Painting. So this is into the 90s. She became popular with the U.S. audiences when she hosted Sister Wendy's American Collection, where she went to American museums to discuss art masterpieces. Her last television documentary was in 2002. It was Sister Wendy at the Norton Simon Museum here in Pasadena, California.
Ah, I never saw that one.
So, no, I want to find that. I that would be cool, because I like the Norton Simon, too. I like their collection a lot, actually.
Yeah.
She dies at 88 years of age at the Carmelite Monastery in Quiddenham? I don't know. Quidditch? I don't know how to pronounce it. But 88 years old, and again, here's a thing where, the thing that someone's most famous for, in this case, hosting these documentaries, the least... of really what her life was about.
Right.
You know,
right? A whole life of living the monastery in the convent, and a couple documentaries, and there you go.
Yeah, serving people in myriad ways, no doubt. Sister Wendy. All right, Daryl Dragon, Dean. Who was Daryl Dragon?
Wow, from the. I don't know. Who's Daryl Dragon?
Died at 77 years of age. He was one half of what 1970s soft rock superstar duo?
Oh, Hall & Oates.
No. You're thinking Daryl Hall. And then the other person would be named Oates. But very, very well played. He was not only a soft rock superstar, but he achieved the rank of captain in the band Captain and Tennille.
Oh, Captain and Tennille. I barely remember them.
Oh, that is unacceptable. That is unacceptable. They had a number one hit song in 1975 with Love Will Keep Us Together, a Cracker Jack song. And not only a Cracker Jack song in and of itself, but a song in which Tony Tennille throws in a improv tribute to Neil Sedaka, who she saw in concert the night before. So if you're listening to the end of the song, you hear her just throw in a Sedaka is back. And anyway, so that was a big hit, and I love that. The song won a Grammy for Record of the Year. Other tunes of theirs that were big hits, Muskrat Love in 1976, and their last big hit, 1979's Do That to Me One More Time. Now, they had a short-lived variety series on television in the 1970s, and it was short-lived not because people didn't watch. The ratings were huge, Dean Hagland. It was short-lived because the captain, Daryl Dragon, was not comfortable on television, and so he ended the show after one season.
Oh, because I seem to recall this variety show with kind of very bizarre, innovative sketches, if I'm not mistaken. So I'm shocked. Yeah, I sort of went, oh, that's a very funny variety show with Captain and Tennille. And then it was.
I think I got turned on to Shields and Yarnell on that show. They featured them.
The big superstar mime duo.
When was the last time you could say that? Superstar mime duo. Not since Hagland and Lernes has there been a. Listen to the podcast from the superstar mime duo Hagland and Lernes. All right. He was a keyboard player in the backing band for the Beach Boys from 67 to 72. And it was Mike Love that nicknamed him Captain because of how he was responsible for driving the ship musically. And so as a joke, he started wearing what would become his trademark, a captain's hat. He and Tony Tennille were married for 39 years. They divorced in 2014, remained friends, and she was by his side when he died.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, and this one really hit me, because no matter how old this guy got, he just seemed to get funnier and funnier to me. Bob Einstein.
Super Dave Osborne.
Yeah, known for his role as the bumbling stuntman, Super Dave, on the TV show. And, of course, for the last however many years, playing, the name makes me laugh, Marty Funkhauser on Larry David's Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yep, exactly. I was on Super Dave's show when he was filming up in Vancouver.
Oh, my God, really?
Yep, I auditioned for him, and he thought it would be funny if when I took off my ball cap, I had a long hair wig in the cap, even though I had long hair. That was a comedy bit. And then, of course, the crew, the costumes did not do that. So he was upset the day I came to set. There was no long hair wig in the ball cap.
He created the Super Dave character actually in the 70s and appeared as a guest on a lot of television shows, including Letterman, before getting his own variety series based on the character, which is hilarious, which aired on Showtime. And I guess Global Television Network in Canada?
Yeah, that was the show. So it was a show that he did there too. No singing, but all sorts of skits.
Yeah, and it was and his character was known for a. it's just funny to remember. I mean, it still holds up, I think, because he, I mean, deadpan doesn't describe it. I mean,
right.
But he was known for attempting difficult stunts that always ended badly. Always.
Right.
And,
at the end of it. Yeah.
He had a recurring role on Arrested Development as Larry Middleman. And again, so hilarious as a foil for Larry David. On Curb Your Enthusiasm. He started out as a writer for the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, and dear God, the all-star talent. I mean, we've talked a lot about your show of shows. We need to analyze the writing staff of the Smothers Brothers, because that's a who's who as well. I mean, that had Chevy Chase and Steve Martin, you know, and so that would be an interesting one to look at. But Bob Einstein started out as a writer for that. And, of course, the older brother of actor, filmmaker Albert Brooks.
Right. Albert Brooks, who's also, that's his stage name. His real name is Albert Einstein.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. You don't need to, you don't need a degree in physics to figure out why he maybe changed that name. All right. Super Dave, Bob Einstein, what a funny, funny guy. I mean, I was going to say, don't you wish you could be a fly on the wall at some of his family, you know, at that family's dinner table with Bob Einstein and Albert Brooks there?
I don't know. You know, the being on a show, he was a craftsperson. He was a jokes and gag craftsperson. So there wasn't a lot of riffing and joshing and laughing it up
but you just think with reacting to his younger brother, you know how younger brothers love to be clever and show off their cleverness.
And that's true.
Can't you imagine how much his deadpan wit was honed and perfected reacting to Albert Brooks?
Yeah, I can see that a lot, actually.
The reason I didn't say, wouldn't you like to be a spider on or a fly on the wall on that, was because I just watched a Norm Macdonald episode where he answered that question by saying, no, of course you wouldn't want to be a fly on the wall because you'd just be scared of spiders and shit and you wouldn't understand a word that anyone was saying.
Classic.
So, there you go. All right, that brings us to the end of a very interesting, globetrotting installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Yes, so many. All our shows, you can hear all of them. Every show we've ever done. Oh, can you hear me still?
Yeah, I can hear you. Where can people find those shows, Dean?
Well, you can find it at chillpackhollywood.com, spelled C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com.
Absolutely. Can people like us on Facebook?
Oh, I wish they would. Please like us, Facebook.com/ChillPackHollywood. Where are we on Twitter and Instagram?
Oh, well, we're at Dean and Phil. We haven't posted a photo in a long time. I better do that. And we better get a lot of photos when you're out for the wedding so that we have like a year's worth of Instagram photos.
Fantastic.
That's at Dean and Phil. And finally, write us, won't you?
Please write us. We're at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, and we answer all the emails, don't we?
No. Well, the ones that are of interest to us where we have something to add.
Oh, right. Yeah. Other than that, we don't answer.
No, and that's what we mean when we say it's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Okay, until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Guests of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.